Good afternoon and welcome to the regular briefing by the Baker-Polito administration to the municipal chief executive officers of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts regarding the COVID-19 pandemic and the partnership between cities and towns and the state in protecting the public health and moving us forward during the most challenging times in recent memory. The lieutenant governor who chairs this briefing is still at the daily briefing that the governor and lieutenant governor provide to the citizens of the Commonwealth. She will be joining us shortly. Again, my name is Jeff Beckwith. I'm the executive director of the MMA. Massachusetts Municipal Association is privileged to serve as the sort of platform through which the lieutenant governor and the whole team of folks on behalf of the administration present very timely and informative updates to all of you and then answer questions. As the lieutenant governor is preparing to come finish that briefing and come upstairs to her office to join us, we'll turn to the stalwart of municipal finance for the administration and for all of us, Sean Cronin, who's the Senior Deputy Commissioner of Revenue in charge of the Division of Local Services. Sean will provide some finance and budget updates for us since the governor signed the budget into law last week. And then we'll be taking questions. And again, as always, please post your questions in the chat for panelists and all attendees to see. And then I'll do my best to walk us through those questions during the hour. The audio recording of this briefing will be posted on the MMA website, and a summary article will be prepared that provides all of the information that is covered during this call. So to Dr. Madoff and Assistant Commissioner Ferguson, thank you again for being here with us. Perhaps we'll hear from you later during the briefing, but right now it's our pleasure to have Sean Cronin present to us. Thanks, Sean.
Great. Thank you, Jeff, very much. So very briefly, touch on a couple of items. So as Jeff mentioned, the budget was signed by the governor late last week. And it does include the UGA and Chapter 70 funding levels that were included as part of the agreement over the summer between the governor and legislature and also in the revised House 2. Basically level funding for UGA and level funding Chapter 70, but in about 8 or 12 districts, there was a, I think, cumulative $100+ million increase in the line item. So great news for municipal budgets on that front. And just to note that the cherry sheets, we'll be pushing them out probably, hopefully, tomorrow, perhaps Thursday. Now we're just working with DESE on the final numbers around charter schools and school choice. So once those are done, we'll push out the cherry sheets through the regular DLS alert program. So be on the lookout for those. If you have any questions on those, you know, you can reach out to Lisa Kriswicki at local aid division. She can answer any questions you might have there. Another highlight in the budget, Community Compact, the Best Practice Program, and the Efficiency and Regionalization Grant Program are both funded at $1 million. And actually, the governor also included a supplemental budget last Friday that included another $1 million for each of those. So out of the gate, we have at least $1 million for both. Maybe we'll get another $1 million for each. But be on the lookout. We plan to have something right after the first of the year in terms of a kickoff letter from the lieutenant governor that will lay out timelines when the programs open, close, passcodes, those types of things. But we're very excited to be able to run that both of those programs again. And I got to believe that there'll be a lot of interest in getting some funds from those programs to help implement or look at some things that might have had a bright light shone on them over the last few months in terms of managing local government. Perhaps regionalizing certain services around the Commonwealth. Second thing I just want to touch on briefly, coronavirus relief funds, aka CARES Act money. This has come up a lot recently. ANF will have official guidance this week on what's called the reconciliation round for CVRF reimbursements for municipalities. As you know, there were two rounds of funding already. One was at the end of fiscal 20, and the second was in October. And at that point, the expectation was that you'd draw down amounts that were your actuals to date plus estimated through December 30th, which, as you all know, is the current deadline to spend those monies. So the reconciliation round will give communities the opportunity to basically square up everything. We know that there's been some changes by FEMA in terms of what's reimbursable and what's not reimbursable. And that might have been in the FEMA bucket in your application to A&F for CVRF monies. This reconciliation round, you'll be able to account for those changes. So if you're worried that, oh, geez, there was this change in eligibility by FEMA, we were hoping to get, 75% of a certain amount. Now we're only getting 75% of a less amount. Well, you'll be able to true all that up during this reconciliation round with A&F. And we do know that there'll probably have to be another round similar to that in early 21, calendar 21, to really kind of settle everything up. So be on the lookout for that. That will go out through the regular channels, go through a DLS alert. We'll have information on the website as well. But that is really important to note. And just last thing I'll say on that same topic is I'm on weekly CEIT calls with Assistant Commissioner Ferguson. And one of the things that we talk about on each of those is, yes, it's December 15th. That's only 15 days away from the current expiration date. But if you have expenses to make that a CVRF eligible, make them. Get those goods and services in because you'll be able to get reimbursed through this, either this reconciliation round that's going to happen this week, or at least the guidance will go out this week, or at some point in early 21. The key is to get the goods in by December 30th. So again, if there's things that come up over the next couple of days, 2 weeks, that you need to spend money on and it's eligible, spend the money on it, and you'll ultimately be able to get reimbursed. And if there's questions on that, you can reach out either to me or directly to A&F. I'll put in the chat function, there's a question intake email address. Actually, it's not an email address anymore. It's an online application where you can submit questions about eligibility or questions about how the what forms you might need to submit. I'll put that in the chat. It's a direct question to A&F, and they're very good at turning around answers pretty quickly. So that's it on my end, Jeff.
Sean, I see the Lieutenant Governor is about to log on. But while that's happening, there is a question in the chat that says that there were some earmarks passed by the legislature and approved by the governor, some in DHCD line items, some elsewhere. When and how will municipalities who are beneficiaries of such earmarks get their hands on the funds?
I just would need to know exactly what they are. So that's Tom Anderson. So Tom, if you can just shoot me an email, let me know what the line items are. I'll get back, or somebody will get back to you with an answer. But I just don't know off the top of my head the answer to that question.
Great. Thank you very much. Lieutenant Governor, it's great to see you. You are doing back-to-back briefings, one for the general public and now for municipal chief executive officers. Sean started with a high-level overview of the budget and timing of cherry sheets and so on. And now you're here, which is, we're very pleased to see you, appreciative of your partnership and your work. And I'll turn it over to you for your overall opening comments.
Okay, thank you very much, Jeff. The team is doing just fine without me. You probably should continue. I'll go quickly because I know there's always really important questions that come up in the chat, and we're happy to address all of those in the time we have together. Obviously, everyone knows how difficult a second surge is, although we kind of knew that the forecast would bring us to this time. We're in it, and we've got to work it as best we can from all levels. We just came out of our press conference, and a nurse director from Mass General Hospital spoke very eloquently about the pressures on the healthcare system and the medical people who are showing up day after day, and the message from their team is just people just try really, really hard as it is to do everything different over this next holiday, set of holidays, and just be mindful that these medical teams show up for us day after day, and they go home to their families. And the more we can do outside in our respective lives, the better they can do their jobs and caring for all the people that are coming their way, both COVID-related and non-COVID-related. She also said something that was really important, that the people who had non-COVID illnesses that delayed their care from the spring to this fall are really, really sick. And they're trying to get access to the care that they need now. And the more the healthcare system is compromised, the more trouble that is for these individuals. So just really everyone dig in deeper when we felt we couldn't dig in any deeper than we already have. Let me just start with the phase in which we are now in. We obviously look at the data as we have the whole time. It's anchored us, and I hope you feel like it anchors you on the decision-making that comes our way. It's anchored on the data. We said, and we messaged really hard, first of all, November 6th was that adjustment that we made to stay at home, the early closure, the gathering drop. And we messaged about, you know, just really stick to your bubble and your close knit over the Thanksgiving holiday, and we'll see what the numbers show. Well, the numbers showed that in that 13-day period, there was obviously a spike that was associated, we feel, with the holiday, and which prompted us to then make decisions around moving back to the phase three. Step one. So that means that all the step two, phase three businesses would close. And we made some additional adjustments to capacity, going from 50 to 40%, dropping the outdoors to 50, and requiring masks to be worn everywhere, which we had done before. But if you're gathering in a private place, a mask is required when there is more than 10 people and attendees are non-households. So we're trying to really hit that message, because we've been saying about mask covers, how important they are, but also now figure out your bubble and stick with that. The mixing of households is creating community spread, as we can see, and that's what we really need to limit. And that's gonna be tough. We were all hoping, right, for the holidays, we wouldn't have to get to this point, but it is where we are, and we need people to really be mindful of that and make the adjustments. Restaurants, obviously, we made further adjustments there. So we're trying to require the face cover when you come in and sit down, especially when the server is at your table, not to have yours off and have the server have a face cover. Everyone wears the face cover, especially with those interactions, and also limit the time in which you go into a restaurant and consume your meal and have a beverage to 90 minutes. And then reducing that table size to 6, encouraging that be in your family unit, not mixing households. If you're in a gym, wear a mask. If you're in an office and you're with others in your office, you got to wear the mask. If you're in a meeting room with others, you have to wear the mask. If you're in your own space, which is where I am right now, you don't have to wear that mask. But when you go out to the hallway, put it on. Obviously, use all the social media stuff that we put together, the Get Back Mask campaign, the Mask Up campaign, just get it out there, keep it out there. Put the exclamation point on all of that with us. We really appreciate it. Testing was a topic that in our last meeting we discussed extensively. And last week we announced 150,000 rapid tests that they would be available during the month of December to community health centers and community hospitals. We also revised the Stop the Stop the Spread program, announcing 5 new locations and expanding the 3 current locations to be run by Project Beacon, those mega sites in New Bedford, Lynn, and Framingham. With all of these new sites operational, we will have nearly 50 testing sites in the state. Stop the Spread program, we're conducting 110,000 free tests per week. That obviously is a number that's gone up significantly since we started the Stop the Spread. For instance, in September, it was 28,000 per week. So now we're at over 110,000 free tests a week, to put it in that kind of perspective. We're one of the top players in the country around testing. When you add up all of our Stop the Spread on top of the municipally run test sites, and I wanna thank you all very much for starting those test sites up using our protocol. You've taken that seriously. We have about 350 testing sites throughout the Commonwealth. And I know that Sean and his shop have been very helpful, I think, to you in using the CARES Act funds to stockpile your test kits, you know, anticipate what you will need after December 31st, but contract for those kits and services that could fall into your CARES Act COVID fund. Oh, it feels good. Even though we're in the tunnel, we see that light and vaccination is literally upon us. Before coming in the room, we just got a text from Mike Loft down at the Cape Cod Hospital at 2:30. No, it's not 2:30, is it? 2:30 today will be their first vaccination. So they're thrilled. And being on the front line, those COVID-facing medical personnel are lining up. I've seen social media tweets literally dancing in front of their hospitals, excited to get the vaccine and getting that process started. So you know that we have the Pfizer vaccines coming in. The Moderna vaccines will be following closely on the heels. And our plan, obviously blessed by the feds, is being implemented, which is terrific. Starts with clinical and non-clinical healthcare workers doing direct COVID-facing care, long-term care facilities, rest homes, and assisted living facilities. Both staff and residents living in those facilities will be able to access these vaccines, and also thanks to strategic partners in CVS and Walgreens, who will be assisting in that efficient vaccination distribution to those facilities. Police, fire, and emergency medical services. Oh, that's important for all of you. Your personnel will be accessing the vaccines. Congregate care, which include shelters and corrections, home-based healthcare workers, and healthcare workers during doing non-COVID-facing care. All those in the first tranche, by the end of December, we anticipate having 300,000 vaccines that will be distributed according to that plan that I just described. There's also questions about the sort of the logistics of this on the Pfizer vaccine, given the cold temperatures required to preserve the vaccine. The hospitals that have that dry ice and cold storage infrastructure will be receiving that. There are 32 hospitals that provide geographic diversity and cover the state that will be getting that right off. And it's actually happening now. I think one of the hospitals was anticipating their shipment at 7 a.m. and it arrived at 4:30 a.m. So before time, which is even better. Phase two will start. If all goes the way we are planning and the vaccines roll into the Commonwealth as they have been stated that they will, sometime in February, phase two will start with individuals with 2 comorbidities who are at the high risk for COVID-19 complications, workers in early ed, K-12, transit, grocery, utility, food, and agriculture, sanitation, public works, public health, adults over 65, and individuals with 1 comorbidity. Phase three of the plan will start in the spring. We're targeting that April timeframe. And phase three will be to the general public and for others under the age of 65. Wow, that's great to be discussing with all of you. And we will work hard to make sure that the rollout goes as smoothly. We expect some bumpiness at the beginning. It's part of the sort of the process of this, and then just really be as efficient as possible getting to the 5.8 million people that are eligible for the vaccine in the Commonwealth to get the to be able to access the vaccine. I'm not going to go in. I think everyone knows on the there's a first dose and a second dose, and all that has to be managed through a system. We're obviously very in tune with that. Free of charge, everyone knows that. Insurance companies will not charge any out-of-pocket fees or co-payments for the vaccine. The plan that was designed by the Vaccine Advisory Group was committed to equitable distribution, which was important, including communities of color and at-risk populations as priority areas. Let me pivot a little bit to municipal and small business support. I think Sean, you covered some of that in your remarks about the FY21 budget, so I don't have to get into a lot of that, but you know that the Community Compact and Regionalization and Efficiencies Program has received more funding, so we'll be sharing more information about that with you. You could be looking to update your best practices around public health. We've learned a lot in these past months. It could be technology, whatever the things that might be on your back burner, but you want to get to that front burner. That best practices program, the regionalization program, are really helpful to help you deliver services even better as a municipality. There were also funds for public safety staffing grants, which is managed by EOPS, the DLTA, which Sean probably touched upon, and the $10 million. There was a lot of advocacy by municipal officials, you, as well as legislators for the public health dollars. So we're really pleased to see the $10 million in grants to local boards of health included in this budget. That was great. I mean, we thank you for your assistance there. On small business and Main Streets, like you, we've done a lot to advocate with our federal partners to be able to develop some further funding for our states, which would include funding for education, could include funding for housing stability, could include housing for, funds for economic development, small business, downtowns, Main Streets, and boy, we need it. So we're hoping that there'll be a holiday surprise, a good surprise, if you will, from the feds, but we don't know that yet. But so in the meantime, we do have the Mass Growth Capital Small Business Grant Program. Those grants are literally being finalized now. So those funds will be coming to you soon. There's just not enough. We received maybe five times the number of applications that we can fund with the appropriations that are authorized now. We simply need more dollars. And when we get more dollars, we'll be able to take the applications that are already sent to us and be able to apply more funding to those applications. We would not want to see a reapplication in order to access additional funds. So we'll use the applications that are already sort of in the queue and go through them in terms of the priority system that we have. I don't know if Sean talked, but we did receive more funds in the fiscal 21 budget, but we also filed a supplemental because we didn't receive as much of the funding that we felt we needed, anticipating the level of demand among the small business and micro businesses across our state. So the supplemental budget includes more dollars, not for new programs, the proven programs that we know and that are set up to be able to grant dollars and get those dollars turned around to the businesses and to you as quickly as possible. So we hope that the legislature will act on the supplemental budget at very soon, and also the economic development bill. Although we were able to roll out $100 million earlier as part of our partnership for recovery efforts, there is another $700 million of funding in the economic development bill. And we've discussed that on this call before and advocating for the passage of that bill so we can get those dollars out the door as well. And then finally, Apparently, this is the calm before the storm because there is a snowstorm coming. I don't know if it will be a white Christmas or white snow for the holidays, but we know it's going to be a week ending with white snow in many parts of our Commonwealth. We'll be on a storm call later today to monitor what that looks like. And the Mass DOT put together their 2021 snow and ice operations COVID-19 protocols. And I think Jess from our office is going to put up the link. So if you want to take a look at what Mass DOT did for their protocols, you can certainly adopt them locally for your departments if you need to update those best practices given the times in which we live. Finally, we're going to continue to look at the data as we have always done, looking at trends in terms of the COVID positive cases based upon the testing capacity that we've ramped up, and also look at hospitalizations and ICU capacity. Just to put things in perspective on that, in the spring, there were over 4,000 beds occupied by COVID patients. And right now we're at about 1,700 COVID patients hospitalized. ICUs in the spring, we had about 1,000 at the height, COVID patients in ICUs, and we have about 300 now. The Worcester Field Hospital is definitely being used. In fact, by next week, they will be able to staff up to 75 beds at any one time. So far, they have cared for about 74 COVID patients in the Worcester Field Hospital and discharged 40. So they know that they need to ramp up a little bit more and they have staff to be able to do that. Lowell is being built out now, the field hospital with the physical infrastructure and also the staffing plan being assembled for beds at that location as well. On the reopening and rollback process, you probably will have some questions about that. We've always said that we make decisions based upon the data and based upon a lot of input from public health, from the COVID Command Center. And we obviously look at the cluster data that we have been able to develop as part of the contact tracing program. And that has informed the sort of the incremental reopening process as well as the incremental adjustments that we're making with further restrictions. And we've always said that if there is a need in your community that has to be addressed and that you need to go deeper or be stricter with regard to restrictions in your community, that you should take those measures. And we know that some municipalities, Boston and some communities near Boston have done just that. And we understand that that is a decision that local communities can and should make if they feel that will help address some issues that they see as part of their work. With that, we'll go back over to the team and address any questions, Jeff, that you'd like us to do or to take in any information that you need us to track down and get back to you on.
Excellent, Lieutenant Governor. Thank you very much. I have a comment and then all the questions fall into three, I think, broad categories. One has to do with vaccines. One has to do with the state of the reopening process and a number of questions regarding that. And then the third has to do with sort of finances, budgets, and resources. And so maybe we can take those categories in that order, the vaccines, reopening, and then finances. And I see we have about a half an hour left, so that we have plenty of time, I think, to cover this. But first, Lieutenant Governor, I wanna make a point that perhaps the local officials who are on this call aren't acutely aware of. And that is that in the vast majority of states outside of Massachusetts, the executive branch does not provide the local decision-making authority regarding the reopening process for municipalities that the Lieutenant Governor and the Governor are providing to all of you. And so while there may be questions about which phase of the reopening process to be in some communities, have announced yesterday that they would be rolling back to step two of phase two, while other communities may decide to stay as the governor has set for the statewide standard, step one of phase three. In most parts of this country, you would not have that flexibility to change and adopt different strategies for your region or for your community. And I think that says a lot about the partnership that cities and towns have with the lieutenant governor and the governor. There may be some regions where communities would like to be more aggressive about the rollback process, in other regions where that may not be as urgent an issue. And you have that flexibility, whereas in most other parts of the country, it would just be calling the governor's office and saying, I'd like to be stronger. I'd like to be less strong in the reopening process. And that's that I think needs to be called out and underscored as part of the fundamental kind of relationship that we have with the executive branch. And I think while there may be disagreements, that level of flexibility should be appreciated.
And we're in a different place than we were when we were starting to manage the pandemic, when we closed the Commonwealth except for essential services. When we reopened, look how much time we spent together designing and developing specific industry sector protocols. And as we incrementally opened industry sectors, we relied on a lot of you to be able to instruct and be available to help businesses adopt these safety protocols and embed them in their operations so that their workers felt more comfortable coming back to work and the public felt comfortable doing business with them. I'm not sure that every state adopted the kinds of strict protocols that we have here. And because of your efforts, there's strong adherence to them. And we know that because we see that in our data that we get through the contact tracing program. Having said that, let me just give you a couple of examples. There was maybe a month ago that Mayor Tyer in Pittsfield had some issues with local restaurants, and she and her team closed indoor dining for 3 weeks. And after the matter resolved, she was able to reopen them. At the beginning of the pandemic, when we allowed for construction to take place, you know, the city of Boston wasn't ready to do that. So they wanted to work on a different set of protocols and work more closely with their business community around construction. And they delayed opening construction for a period of time. Even Boston did not go to step two of phase three when we allowed that to take place on a statewide basis. So there are, and even in this particular announcement that the city of Boston and some others made, they went back to phase two, but not exactly the way it was reopened back in the early part of this effort. So they had an adjustment to it. So some of the activities in that phase were closed, but others remained open. So I think everyone is trying to look at the information and the data that they have and to make the decisions that are best for them. And we completely understand that and respect that.
And we appreciate that very much. And it is likely if this surge continues and if the unfortunate event occurs that that people do not heed the advice that you gave today and have been giving every single day about the upcoming holidays, then more and more communities or the state as a whole may need to take action regarding what phase we're actually in. One question in the chat is a sort of a reminder or asking for a quick reminder about what you consider to be the most important data points to look at as communities make their own decisions about where to be in the reopening process.
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously the positive COVID cases you know, that is over the 7-day period is important. We're at somewhere around 5.7, whereas in early September, I think we were somewhere in the 2 to 3 range. So that's definitely changed. So you want to continue to look at that. You obviously want to look at hospitalizations and ICU capacity. That's really important. And now what's different there is we can have physical beds, but you need staff to be able to provide the care for that patient. And there are a number of healthcare professionals that are COVID facing that, because now we test, which back in the spring when hospital staff were dealing with COVID, dealing with delivering healthcare, we didn't have the testing available to really know what the status was of everyone. Now we do, and there are more hospital staff that have COVID or are quarantining because they were close contact to someone that has it. So that we will continue to watch as well to make sure that we have the medical staff to administer the care for beds that are occupied in our hospitals and our ICUs. Remember also that hospitals, as part of the restrictions that we just recently announced and went into effect yesterday or Sunday, they are limiting elective inpatient procedures in order to free up more bed capacity to provide care for people that have emergencies as well as need COVID care. That was a big ask of the hospital systems across the state. At the same time, we rolled back to step one of phase three. So I would look at those. The trends on the positive cases based upon the testing that we have available, and look at hospitalizations and ICUs.
Thank you very much. Very comprehensive answer. You have a public health future as well as a political future, Lieutenant Governor. Another question that is related to, I think, reopening, because testing is a part of that to ensure the capacity. What is the plan regarding contact tracing? As more and more people are testing positive, the contact tracing process becomes more and more difficult. It's been, are you stepping up those efforts? What's the status of contact tracing?
Yeah, I'm going to ask the public health folks to take that one on, because I believe that there was a discussion point at our last meeting around the protocol for that. Can you speak to that further so that we can be very clear? And if there is a link to anything that we can share in the chat, let's please do that.
Thank you very much, Lieutenant Governor. I'd be happy to speak about this. I know that there have been a lot of questions around how local health departments can access supports through the Community Tracing Collaborative, because this is really part of the infrastructure to support your own local contact tracing and case investigation efforts. This is something that local health departments do routinely, but given the number of cases associated with COVID, the governor's administration really put together this Community Tracing Collaborative infrastructure to support that. Now, we've all been seeing, as the Lieutenant Governor outlined, a large number of cases increasing over the fall, and particularly in the last couple of weeks since Thanksgiving. The Community Tracing Collaborative is responding both to that surge in individual cases, as well as an increasing number of cases and contacts being referred by your municipalities, by your local health departments to the CTC in order to do that work. So they started really staffing up and training new staff earlier in the fall. They're expecting to have, they're training a new cohort starting every Monday. So right now they're about 250 to 300 new staff being trained. They go through a week's training, then they're up and running, and they're anticipating being fully staffed with both FTEs as well as temp supports by December 26th. They'll be fully staffed. In the meantime, however, they are continuing to do case investigations and contact tracing. There are new kind of surge protocols that have been put in place, including a tiny URL that I'll type into the chat that is really a self-supporting isolation and quarantine support that even your municipalities could refer people to if they have questions about how to isolate safely or quarantine safely and to prepare for that. And even to understand like what it means by who is a close contact and how to do outreach as well. So that's another thing. I'll put that into the chat. They've also set up an incoming call line. I'll be happy to put that phone number in where people can reach out individually to the Community Tracing Collaborative. But I would like to reiterate that this is when your local health department has chosen to use that resource. As the Lieutenant Governor mentioned, there are different numbers in your community, so some of you may not need to access that additional capacity now. But if you do, it's there. And for those over 180 municipalities that are using it routinely and really sending about 3,500 cases a day over to the CTC. There are a tremendous amount of supports there. Even if people aren't getting calls immediately, they were getting to them in 24 hours. They can't get to them in 24 hours anymore. But by the end of December, we're hoping we're back into that kind of cadence. So it'll be really important to stay in touch with your health departments about what they're seeing and feel free, your health departments can feel free to reach out to me if they're having any individual concerns. We can connect them with their local health liaison. So I'll put the tiny URL in particular in the chat for everybody. But I do want you to know that there is a process in place that's really working to get as many people as possible, and also an effort to restaff that we're really hoping to see really in the next 10 days. It should be fully up.
Was there an update to the number of times a contact tracer contacts someone?
Yeah, that's a good point. Lieutenant Governor. So as part of the surge protocols and while people were staffing up, they had the CTC had to reduce the number of times. Well, there were a couple of things, but one of them is that they were just doing one call, initial outreach, a text and a voicemail to say that they had tried to reach somebody. And then there was a kind of an administrative procedure that made that look like that was done and it was closed if they couldn't reach someone. That was misleading. It didn't give good information about the fact that there was subsequent follow-up with this Community Tracing Collaborative and some of those contacts. Okay. But also because of the increased staff, they've been able to increase the number of times that they would reach out to an individual case or contact. Okay. So it's multiple times over multiple days at different times as well to try to make sure that you're not missing somebody because they're at work, for example. So there's a lot more effort in that. And then those texts will still go out that'll have both the tiny URL and an incoming call line to really facilitate the opportunity for people to reach out directly at their own convenience as well.
Thanks for that clarification.
Thank you. I'm going to try and do some Zoom, share a Zoom trick for anyone who's feeling a little overwhelmed that we have so many links posted in the chat and you're trying to figure out how to copy them. If you open the chat window, at the bottom side, there should be three little teeny dots next to each other. I believe that for most, and Timory can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I think that attendees can actually click on those three little dots, and one of those will provide you an opportunity to save the chat. And then you can save it. It'll save it on your computer, and then you can just later on go and take a look at the at all of the links that are being posted without being overwhelmed and distracted trying to copy them right now. The other thing is that we will post all of these in the MMA summary article on the MMA website as well. So I hope that little Zoom hint actually works for people who are viewing a webinar. I know that we have about 15 minutes left, and I want to make sure to get to some questions on vaccines. We did have a question that came in directly to MMA, and perhaps Assistant Commissioner Ferguson can answer this as well. Just a question wondering about where municipal employees fall in the process. Lieutenant Governor, you mentioned first responders in the first category, and then public works and others in the second phase. So there was a question about where administrative staff would fit in, especially those that are public facing, providing public services. So how do people find out, how do municipal officials find out how their employees and municipal employees fall in the
vaccine? That's a very good question. And obviously, Jana and Dr. Madoff can talk about that. These are big buckets, if you will, within the plan that I went down. And you're probably wondering, do I fit in this particular section or this section? I think Secretary Sutter's announced today an email that you can send. And I don't know if we can put that into this chat, but there is an email that if you have a question or somebody comes to you with a question, you can send your email and you'll get a response. And the document that the COVID Command Center will get updated weekly or maybe more than that with this information. So there it is. Can you expand on that, Jana?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. And Dr. Madoff, if you'd like to also feel free. I would just say that I typed the email that Lieutenant Governor just talked about and the Secretary Sutter's mentioned at the press conference. This is COVID-19, that's the number, -vaccine-plan-ma@mass.gov. Again, it's in the chat. But this is an email that goes to our vaccine planning unit. And one of the big questions that a lot of people are having is kind of where they fit into those big broad buckets that Lieutenant Governor just went through. And this website or this email is a staffed email and people can respond. Or if they hadn't considered it, that's something that they can then know for planning, you know, something that might be really important for planning. In addition to that, there are questions about local roles in vaccine clinics and things like that can also be sent to that website, so that or that email address. So that's a multi-purpose email address for those kinds of questions.
I did notice, for example, there are some categories that are provide essential functions that maybe hadn't been thought of. One just came in regarding consideration of poll workers if communities are holding elections. And the poll workers fall into the last categories. How will they make sure to have enough poll
workers? Well, some poll workers might fall into an earlier category depending on their individual health or age or job if they are doing that as a volunteer. So the other point is if all goes according to our plan by spring, we will see the general public and people that don't fall into a prior category under the age of 65 starting to get the vaccine. So depending on the time of your local election, it could be that that phase is already well underway.
And a question that I'm sure municipal officials are starting to receive from their employees, which is, will vaccination distribution be, which is based on profession, be organized by the employer, by the community the individual lives in? How will this be organized in a way that, for example, first responders who fit in the first phase, how is it distributed? How do they access the vaccine?
Okay, that's something you'll need to explain what Jana or Dr. Madoff on the municipality as the employer and how that vaccine to the categories of employees of a municipality will get their vaccine. So you can obviously in phase one are emergency responders as an example. Later are DPW workers. So how is that managed?
Thanks, Lieutenant Governor. So there are, as you know, 351 cities and towns, and every situation is probably going to be a little different. And frankly, not every plan has been worked out yet. We are working on multiple channels to try to get this. And of course, we're focusing right now on acute care hospitals and skilled nursing facilities in this very first phase. You know, we expect that in some municipalities that paramedics are going to be able to receive the vaccine and be able to distribute and vaccinate within their own circles. So for example, other other first responders in their city or town can be done that way. In other situations, we may need to partner with healthcare institutions, with community health centers, and even with retail pharmacies and large scale community vaccination clinics. So it's going to be, this is going to take some time to all put together. And, you know, we ask that you be patient, but this will come. And it's really nice to have, as you say, a light at the end of the tunnel here.
Thank you very much. And there was also a question whether or not communities could, will communities be able to get access to vaccines and distribute immunizations themselves? Is that envisioned for any of these phases?
So as you know, the first vaccines that are coming down the line, the Pfizer vaccine is pretty cumbersome, right? It comes in a container with almost 1,000 doses, and it needs to be stored at minus 70 Celsius. And it's not for you and me to be handling. The next wave of vaccines, the Moderna vaccine, is fortunately a lot more easy to manage. It can be stored at refrigerator or freezer temperatures. It comes in lots of 100, and so it can be distributed in a much more fine-grained way. And I think, after we go to the healthcare facilities, community health centers, some of the larger provider groups and healthcare organizations. I think in the next steps, I think local boards of health and other areas that have vaccination capacity can be prioritized and can be able to receive this. And of course, there may be other formulations of the vaccine. We're very hopeful that will be available before too long as well. We think the Moderna vaccine is going to be approved maybe as soon as today. And there are other vaccines that are in the pipeline that are even easier, perhaps, to manage. And so as that moves forward, we're going to have to be flexible, and we're going to all be working together to make that happen.
Thank you. There's a couple more questions, and then we'll pivot to the finance piece and finish off. One question was whether or not to, for those communities that have elections that are scheduled for after March 31st, would it make sense then for them to move those to earlier dates? Would they be able to take advantage of mail-in voting, for example, and have safer voting conditions? Is that something that the administration has thought of recommending, since early voting was continued in the budget provision, but only through March 31st, I believe? Vote by mail, I mean.
Yeah. Vote by mail, yeah, right. We'll have to look at that more closely and see where we are closer to that time. But I know you would want to make some decisions on that fairly early. I'd have to think about, you have to think about what's best in your community. You know your community's best and how to satisfy their desires and obviously access. We just went through a presidential election, and we had the highest turnout in terms of participation in an election ever in the history of this Commonwealth. It was great to see. We can talk further about that, see if there's more guidance that you want us to develop along those lines.
Well, that's a very interesting question that Bob LaLasher posted, because I think that shows that looking down the road, there are a lot of sort of planning issues that are important to address and start to think about in real time now, given how complicated the situation is. So thank you. We look forward to exploring that more. Final question on vaccines is for people that may have a compromised health condition that elevates their vaccination priority, how are they identified? Is that through their primary care provider and so on? And then is that impacted person the only one in the household that receives the early vaccination?
That's a good question. I'll have one of the medical folks, public health folks, take that one on.
To answer the second part first, the vaccination prioritization only applies to the individual, not to their household. So if you're over 65 and have two medical conditions that would qualify, that qualifies you, but not your other household members. The idea, and I think the Vaccine External Advisory Committee really handled this extremely well, and they wanted to safeguard lives, and I think that was their priority in doing this, and protect the most vulnerable, and as well as protect the function of society, and so those individuals would be prioritized and not their contacts. In terms of identification, certainly providers and healthcare organizations have access to this information on what exactly are a person's comorbidities, their coexisting conditions. And that's going to be extremely important in making sure that the most vulnerable are referred to care and get themselves vaccinated through their providers, through through those healthcare organizations. And that's probably how we're going to most of those vulnerable individuals. It's still going to be in a fairly early phase of this. So I think that answers the question primarily. I mean, there are going to be, it's going to be complicated as we move forward and go to more public facing clinics. And there's going to be some self-identification and referral of people themselves to these settings.
But also the tracking of the first and second doses to make sure that they comply with the time frames and the follow-up that's needed, that all gets documented through your healthcare provider.
Absolutely. It makes it extremely complicated. And obviously getting the first dose, we need to make sure everybody gets the second dose, because then that first dose is wasted we're not meeting the goal. A few other questions just on finances. I think a few of them came from folks who arrived after Sean gave the update. Essentially, Sean was unable to share any insight into what the federal government may or may not do in terms of direct aid. Lieutenant Governor, you did mention the $700 million economic development bond bill that's pending before the legislature. If local officials here will just call your House and Senate members and ask them to pass that as quickly as possible, then there are resources that can be very helpful to help your economic development and businesses during this extremely difficult time. There's housing money in there, a lot of opportunities.
And the supplemental budget, those are operating dollars that we can grant out quickly.
Exactly.
And that's sort of the balance of what we had proposed in the first budget that we presented to the legislature.
Yes, the legislative session ends during the first week of January, but we really hope that action on the supplemental budget and the economic development bill takes place really as quickly, immediately.
Yes.
The federal government's unclear whether or not that CARES Act deadline is going to be extended. It all depends on what the compromises are regarding state and local aid and liability. That's a big holdup in passing a package right now. And Lieutenant Governor, we know you and the governor are working with the National Governors Association. We're working with the National League of Cities and other organizations to just try, create a massive sense of urgency. If local officials want to please give a reminder call to your House and Senate members here in the Commonwealth, talking about federal, to ask them to make sure this happens. Every single member of the Massachusetts delegation is a strong supporter of aid, much higher than the compromise package that is pending right now. But we just need action right away and get a second package a little bit later if that's the way it happens. But waiting until February or March is way too late. Any other, Sean, I don't know if you've been able to see in the question regarding in the chat regarding any other questions regarding municipal finances.
I'll just add one thing that I don't think I touched on earlier that I should have. FEMA reimbursement, even though it's not as, there's more restrictions to it, and it's only 75% as opposed to 100 under CBRF money, that does not end on December 30th. So make sure to go to the MEMA website on the mass.gov site. There's a whole section I was checking out the other day, a whole section about eligibility questions, how to contact your local liaison from MEMA that have staffed up for this. So just remember that there still is some federal money available for eligible expenses even if there's no change to the December 30th, different pots of money, different rules and stuff, but make sure you check that out and you talk with your local FEMA folks because that is available for you after December 30th until the presidential declaration of emergency goes away.
Thank you. And then this is the last time that I ever give Zoom advice or tips over the over a live broadcast. Timmery has informed me that most people aren't able to save the chat, as I suggested you try. So please go to the MMA website later this afternoon. The MMA story will that's posted will include all of the links references that have been provided in the chat. So you'll be able to get access to them at that time. And again, I was on the audiovisual crew in high school, and I think I should limit myself to film strips and cassette decks, which is what I was helping people with then. Lieutenant Governor, I have a chance to now turn it over to you for any closing words, and then I'll announce the date of our next briefing.
Again, thank you everybody for working through these extraordinary times. We have the COVID response, we have a vaccine to roll out, we have economic pressures on your smallest businesses and on the jobs and opportunities for people in your community. You have schools that are trying to operate in a way that can provide a meaningful educational experience for kids. I mean, housing, every part of government, state or local, is touched and has a challenge to deal with. So just want to say thank you. I'm not sure when we're going to meet next, and I just want to wish you a safe, different holiday, and may you find joyful moments with those who you love. And just can't say enough about how proud I am of the work that each one of you has done to help your communities and help our Commonwealth, and how much I look forward to 2021 with all of you when we continue these meetings and our effort together, and we get to brighter, better, and healthier days for everyone.
Thank you, Lieutenant Governor. Sean, Jana, Larry, thank you very much for your participation. On behalf of all of our members, we wish you and your colleagues a joyous and safe holiday. Our next scheduled briefing is on Tuesday, January 5th at 1 p.m., right after the holidays, although Lieutenant Governor has always said that if there needs to be a meeting in between a briefing, some developments, then we will schedule and provide notice to all of you.
Okay, that's great. Thank you for that.
Absolutely. And then as we end this may be the last one of these in 2020, on behalf of the MMA, all of us would like to express our deep appreciation to the local officials of the Commonwealth who are out there working on the front lines. This may be a very difficult holiday season, but you've never been closer to your communities because you have saved more lives and protected more people than any local official in generations. So we thank you for your work. And I give a special shout out to Timmery and Candace for their work behind the scenes. And also Jess and Lily for their work on behalf of the administration behind the scenes, making these briefings possible. Again, go to the MMA website and listen to this again. If you want to listen to the audio recording, send it on to your colleagues and get all of the data and the information you need. Thank you for your participation. We wish you peace. We wish you happiness. And we wish you, most of all, safety and health. Good afternoon.
Thank you.